Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, Republican U.S. Senate candidate Eric Hovde breaks his silence after his narrow defeat, but stops short of conceding. Will he request a recount? Plus, the future of reproductive rights was front and center of the state Supreme Court on Monday. And now that Republicans have tighter majorities next year, could it lead to more compromise? We hear from two legislative leaders. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for November 15th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We're going to begin with U.S. Senate candidate Eric Hovde, and he is still refusing to concede in the U.S. Senate race. So did the days following after the election, he was really silent after Wednesday morning, after Senator Tammy Baldwin claimed victory. She was declared the winner. Looking at unofficial results, she is up by a little bit more than 29,000 votes. So we didn't really hear from him until he posted a social video on Tuesday, a nearly about 5-minute video posted on X, formerly known as Twitter, where he made a series of false claims about the election that were either false or misleading. And he opened the possibility of a recount. He said he's deeply concerned. He knows it's very serious if he were to take this action. Before we dive more into this and some of those claims, JR, let's just hear from Hovde kind of explaining himself, his thought process over these last 7 to 10 days. Meanwhile, the response from Republicans, who basically called him a sore loser, they want him to step out. He even said before the campaign that he would accept the election results. So kind of some dueling narratives that we're going to take a listen to right now before we dive deeper into this topic.
Many people have reached out and urged me to contest the election. While I'm deeply concerned, asking for a recount is a serious decision that requires careful consideration. Once the final information is available and all options are reviewed, I will announce my decision on how I will proceed.
I think it shows that he's a sore loser. I think that, you know, once the election results came in, he should be willing to accept that. That's the will of the people, just as we had to do, losing the state of Wisconsin for the candidate of my choice, too. But that's what you do. It is an election. You're going to have winners and you're going to have losers. The main thing is that the people spoke, and you have to respect that.
Many GOP operatives that I talked to after Hovde's video told me that they were pretty much blindsided. There was, I think a lot of people heard the same type of tip earlier in the day that Hovde was filming some type of video, and there was an understanding from many prominent Republicans that he was going to drop out of the race. But he did all but that in this video, JR.
So let's look at the big picture going forward. So first, we will have county canvasses completed by early next week. They're due by Tuesday, I believe. Once you have the canvasses in, and that could happen actually today, you have 3 business days after that to then request a recount. At the current margin, it's 0.9% between Baldwin and Hovde. So right now, if that holds in the canvas, and sometimes numbers change, he could request a recount, but he has to pay for it. If it's 0.25% or less, the gap between the first and second place finisher, the recount is covered by taxpayers. So at this gap, the question is, do you want to spend millions of dollars to recount ballots when nothing's going to change? I mean, granted, you could find bags of ballots that weren't counted on election days. You could find, like, mistakes. But unless you're going to do, like, hand-to-hand combat, we talked before, about every single ballot and try and find you have to net 29,000-plus votes out of a recount. You're not going to do that. This doesn't happen in Wisconsin or anywhere I've seen. So the question becomes, what would the whole point of a recount be? And people I talk to can't quite figure out what the point would be. Have you heard, like, what would be the point?
I have not. Okay. And what I kind of looked into further is kind of the historical nature of recounts. I mean, many people know we had one in 2020 that was brought forth by former President Donald Trump, now president-elect. He had one in Dane and Milwaukee County. When you look at the vote thresholds, it only changed about 200 votes. Mm-hmm. So that clearly wasn't enough to, you know, fill the void between the difference between him and President Joe Biden. Meanwhile, looking back from all the way back to the year 2000, during the infamous Florida recount between Al Gore and George W. Bush, that is really, since then, there's been 36 statewide elections that have been recounting of the votes. Only three of them have been overturned. So really, out of like thousands of these, you know, statewide elections, it's very, very rare for that many votes, like you mentioned, to overturn the election outcome.
In 2020 with like Wisconsin, it was you find a vote, like, for example, if you have the oval that you fill in and somebody like put a check by it, can you discern the voter's intent and add? I think they added more ballots in than they did anything else with the recount in Milwaukee and Dane County. So that's why I'm not quite sure what the point is. And now Hovde made this comment about they don't check the integrity of the ballot in a recount, suggesting there is some kind of something afoul. Well, you could sue to throw out ballots. That could be an option, but then you're talking like months and months to get it's kind of a questionable strategy right now for people I talk to.
Right. Now we're kind of just going to dig into some of Hovde's claims because they have since been debunked by state election officials and those at the local and county level that at least I've talked to this week. So let's kind of dive into this to explain to viewers something like for the first fact. Hovde claimed around 1 a.m. on election night, based on the models, it appeared I would, quote, win the Senate race. Well, in fact, there were still a lot, tens of thousands of ballots still being processed at central count cities like Milwaukee, Racine, and Green Bay. And when you look at the historical nature of those large cities, they were going to heavily favor Baldwin, not Hovde. Another claim by Hovde, Milwaukee reported approximately 108,000 absentee ballots, with Senator Baldwin receiving 90% of those ballots. Well, in reality, Baldwin won only 82% of Milwaukee's absentee ballots. Last claim we want to dive into is that Hovde said that there were wards where the amount of votes was 150%, even 200% of the amount of registered voters. Well, that is typically not unusual here in Wisconsin because the vote totals can exceed the number of registered voters because of the state law that Wisconsin has that allows same-day voter registration. This is an issue that I spoke to Michelle Hawley. She is the executive director of the Milwaukee Election Commission about trying to just explain this. Let's first take a listen to her and her comments about this.
It is possible to register to vote on Election Day. And so the numbers on our website that reflect the number of registered voters were pulled as of the day before the election. We do not go back after the election and then, you know, tabulate how many registered voters participated on Election Day and then go back. That's a static number as of the day before the election. So as you can see on the county's website, we have put that disclosure in there that because Election Day registration is allowed, and it is my understanding that in Oak Creek, about 2,700 people registered to vote on Election Day, then it would certainly be possible that a ward would have over 100% participation. So the law says that we are not allowed to start processing absentee ballots until 7 o'clock on Election Day. And so to process 100,000 ballots in one day, does take a long time.
I want to go back to that first claim of Hovde saying, well, yeah, at 1 a.m., it did look like you were going to be the winner. But there are still many, many more ballots at Central Count that typically favor Democrats. And that was widely pointed out by many GOP operatives on election night.
Yeah, in fact, Joe Hendrick, a longtime Republican redistricting consultant, also a very good follower on election nights. He crunches a lot of numbers, knows wards very, very well. He predicted during the day on election day, like, okay, look, here's the swing he expected out of Milwaukee, Wauwatosa, Green Bay, Kenosha, Racine, once their central counts came in. He was fairly close to the swing in Milwaukee that we saw, so this wasn't a surprise. On election night, Hendrick again reiterated the numbers. Eric Bott, who's with Americans for Prosperity, a conservative group, was saying it looks like Hovde's not up high enough to withstand the Milwaukee vote. And it wasn't a dump or a fraud. This was just they finished up now. They could have started earlier election day voting or counting than they did. They had a mistake. They had to start over in 31,000 ballots. It delayed things, but that wasn't a sign of fraud. That was not doing things maybe more as efficiently as they could have to start the day. Another thing that Hovde brought up was this claim of 8 million registered voters in Wisconsin in the roll. This has been brought up repeatedly by people making claims about the elections. Look, there are 3.5 to 3.7 million active registered voters in Wisconsin. There is a list that has about 7 million plus records on it that includes inactive voters. As you know, we've seen the same thing I have from the Elections Commission. If you are inactive, you cannot vote with that registration. You have to go back and re-register. So if I'm deactivated, I go to the polls and ask to vote, they'll say, you're not in the poll book. You have to re-register. You have to have your photo ID and your other information to re-register. Go over here and activate registration. There's no 8 million people in the poll book. It's basically not an avenue to commit fraud or to request an absentee ballot. You have to be an active registrant. But it's been pushed over and over again, people trying to say there's something wrong with the elections in Wisconsin because they don't want to accept that fact, apparently.
Right. And Hovde also once again talked about the plant that he claims that Democrats put on the ballot, that's Leaguer. You know, he was even talking to us this week, and I also saw him on another Milwaukee TV station saying, like, yes, I didn't know that Dems helped me get on the ballot, which they did during the process of putting names on the ballot. But he said, quote, you know, I'm a conservative. I'm not a Democrat. So I don't know, you know, why he keeps pointing blame at me. Also, we've talked about this before, JR, the total number of votes that Leaguer got wouldn't he have made, if you gave them all to Hovde, it still wouldn't have beat Tammy Baldwin.
No, it would be in like serious recount territory.
Oh, absolutely.
And like
state yes. Yeah.
More, but yes. And also, we talked last week, I heard from numerous Republicans that there's a reason why those folks who didn't vote for Hovde voted for Leaguer. There was no mystery that Eric Hovde was Donald Trump's guy. So they felt something was off with him, Hovde, and didn't want to back him for whatever reason. So that's why he fell behind Donald Trump.
So overall, by next week, Hovde will have to make a decision. Mm-hmm. He left open the door to a recount and said he is just waiting for those final canvas reports to be turned in. So I would suspect sometime by Tuesday, Wednesday, we'll hear from Hovde. And I know, JR, you talked to him too, that he said that next announcement will be coming in another video.
Yes.
All right, let's move on to oral arguments this week that put reproductive rights really front and center of the state Supreme Court. Now, this is all related to an 1849 law that has been on the books and has been relitigated ever since the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Now, this law would ban most abortions in the state. Now, during oral arguments over this 19th century law, you know, justices got a little chippy on the matter. Now, it would have one exception, this law, to save the life of the mother. Now, the court, which is controlled 4-3 by liberals, will ultimately decide this is the issue. Is that 1849 law banning most abortions enforceable in modern times? This has been a lawsuit brought forth by Attorney General Josh Call and Governor Tony Evers. Meanwhile, the issue before the court is conservatives arguing basically that, hey, this was never removed from the books. This is the law that we should go back to. Meanwhile, on the other hand, Democrats argue it is just too old and can't forget there was a lower court ruling that basically said this is not enforceable and does not apply to consensual abortions. Let's just take a listen from liberals and conservatives on the court arguing some of these main issues.
What you are asking this court to do is to sign the death warrants of women and children and pregnant people in this state. Because under your interpretation, they could all be denied life-saving medical care while the medical professionals who are charged with taking care of them are forced to sit idly by. This is the world gone mad. I don't understand how that is not the crime here.
Unless there's some conflict, the laws were not reversed off the books. I don't know why, as a matter of straight, just reasonable statutory interpretation, the law's still there. It's still there. The judiciary doesn't get to edit laws. The judiciary doesn't get to rewrite them. We didn't delete it. We prevented its enforcement. Now it's still there. How can we just say, oh, we can't enforce it anymore, simply because the legislature was doing other things when it was unenforceable?
Watching oral arguments this week, one thing that I did notice is Liberal Justice Janet Protasiewicz, who was just elected to the bench, was pretty quiet on the court. Of course, she infamously talked a lot about her support for abortion rights during the campaign trail, which was nitpicked heavily by Republican lawmakers. Even, you know, the possibility that was tossed out there of impeaching her, that ended up never happening. But overall, this is an issue that I think, you know, both sides have been wanting to resolve. We've seen efforts by the legislature, specifically Republicans, to try to, you know, put a referendum on the ballot, have, you know, voters decide this issue. Nothing has really been going anywhere for many years, but this would ultimately try to set at least one legal argument.
Yeah. While Janet Protasiewicz was fairly quiet, fellow liberals, Joe Karofsky and Rebecca Dallet, were not. Some blowback from conservatives this week because they felt like both of them were focusing more on policy than the law. I mean, Karofsky at one point said, we got to get this right. Dallet's comment about when this law was passed by only white landowning males being able to vote at the time, conservatives will say, well, look, that's not what the standard is for the law. The law is about what's on the books. And that question is about whether the ensuing laws passed post Roe v. Wade repeal implicitly the 1849 law. For example, you have a 20-week ban on the books put there in 2015. There's parental consent, other laws. There was a law passed in the 1980s about viability that at one point had a provision in it that would have repealed explicitly the law, but it was taken out in the end. So the question legally is, okay, did we repeal this essentially by saying this is the standard? And now the argument was, from the conservative side, there's no conflict in those laws. You can apply all of them. The liberal side, no, there actually is a conflict. You can't carry out both. You have to do one or the other, ergo one has to come off. Judge Slipper, the Dane County judge, who would rule that doesn't really apply to a consensual abortion, only applies to infanticide. I'm not sure how that's going to play in the final decision because you have dual tracks. Slipper only focused on that issue, didn't take up the whether it was succeeded by these other laws, but it kept the issue alive before the Supreme Court, which is the one that Call has raised, that he believes this has been repealed essentially by new laws. Worth noting, there's a second lawsuit Planned Parenthood filed about abortion that seeks to declare there's a right to bodily autonomy in the state constitution that would then guarantee the right to abortion. Planned Parenthood did a news conference call after oral arguments this week and said, hey, we're waiting for that one. There's been no briefing schedule yet in that lawsuit. But if that comes to pass and we would win that lawsuit, then we would challenge the 20-week ban, for example, or other restrictions, because if there's a right to bodily autonomy, it could put those laws into danger. That's not on the ballot. That's not being talked about with this case at all.
Right.
Also,
but there's
worth
a timeline.
Yes.
Right?
So we're wondering when they're going to take that other case up. This case, what's important, too, is there's a Supreme Court contest in April. So when are they going to decide this case? When might they take up the second one, and how might that play in the Supreme Court race in the spring?
Right. I've been asked a lot this week, Emily, when do you think the Supreme Court's going to make a decision on this? You cannot decide that. I mean, you know, some people have hunches. Maybe it's going to be right before the holidays, like the redistricting lawsuit was. There's no schedule. But, you know, I would think at least liberals on the court would be trying to push to get most of their what they believe would like to be coming before the court, making these decisions. But because they're on a, you know, they're on a timeline. I mean, we're going to have of an election in April. There's a primary in February, if there is one. And this is a big fight for control over the court. There's going to be lots of spending. Maybe we'll, you know, reach new record highs at the last one that we saw just last year.
The redistricting case you brought up, oral arguments were in mid-December. They had a decision out by Christmas. That almost never happens.
Right.
Like, that is an unusually tight timeline.
I think we even talked about the rarity of that, yeah, because it was just so bizarre. All right. But it can't happen. So stay tuned, I guess. We cannot predict when they are going to make a decision. All right. Let's just look ahead to, I guess, for the next 2 years, because we're going to be talking about a new state budget. Why? Because state agencies had to get in their proposals for the next two-year spending plan. Here's just some of the big-ticket items that usually get most of the money when it comes to crafting the next state budget. Of course, the Department of Public Instruction, UW System, all of these agencies that you see on here are asking for a big chunk of change. Ultimately, as you often point out, JR, it is rare that you always get what you want, but we kind of want to dive more into these numbers. First, I just want to focus on the Department of Public Instruction because they are asking for the largest increase, $4.3 billion, that's with a B. The rest of these agencies you see on your screen are just asking for millions over the two-year biennium. This is something that, you know, is being touted by the Jill Underly. She's up for re-election. She's the state superintendent of schools. She wants to use a lot of the state surplus to invest in schools. That's something that Democrats, I asked this week, are totally behind. It's a big portion of what Governor Tony Evers ran on and ran on for re-election. Meanwhile, Republicans like Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, addressing reporters this week, basically said, you're not always going to get what you want. And it's very unlikely that they are going to invest that much money into it. So let's just first hear from some legislative leaders on this topic.
We have that surplus because we haven't been spending money on the things we should, which is K-12 education. And that money is sitting there. And that is why we continue to go to referendum over and over and over again, because Republicans have chosen to underfund education. And so people are choosing to raise their own taxes to support their neighborhood schools instead of the state doing what it should do to put that money in the first place.
At least for Assembly Republicans, we are not in a rush to spend that. We are in a rush to return it back to the people of Wisconsin. The best way that we can help folks deal with inflation is by putting the money that they overpaid back in their wallets so that they can choose to spend it on things that are important to their family. I think the idea of spending way more than the amount that we have is off the table. We are not going to raise taxes That's one of the things that I know my colleagues are united around.
Let's start just where we left off. Department of Public Instruction, $4.3 billion, nearly a 30% increase here, JR.
So the increase is off of what's called base year doubled. So when you start doing budgets, you take your second year of the current biennium and say this is your base year, you double that amount, and then you build off of that. So the $4.3 billion is in addition to like what they're currently getting at base year doubled. If you go through the DPI budget, which dorks like me have, the 440-page document that came out yesterday, there are all kinds of policy changes in there too. She wants to change how vouchers are funded, the formula for those. She wants to change with, she announced she wants to change the reimbursement rate for special education to go up from 33% or so to 75% to 90%. She also wants to make it a sum sufficient appropriation, which is a weird term to people at home, but basically it means no matter what is spent, the state would have to put that money forward. So what happens sometimes with aid payments is if there's more demand than we expected as a state, you prorate those payments. If you make it sum sufficient, they get everything they ask for. So lots of stuff like that in there that's interesting to look at. Two, I went through and totaled up everything that was asked for by agencies off their budget requests that were due September 15th. Underlee was a little bit late getting her final document in, put a little bit in back in September, but so these numbers you see on the screen are all from those requests. Next week, the Evers administration will put together an exercise they do every 2 years where it is, this is how much we have for requests from agencies. This is how much we're expecting in revenue now for the rest of this biennium and the next budget through June 30th of 2027. There's a lot of speculation there projecting out, but that becomes the foundation of this whole budget exercise. The Fiscal Bureau, the nonpartisan arm of the legislature, will then do revenue estimates in January. The governor puts budget out in February. Joint finance kicks in gear really in April and May. Then by June, we maybe have a budget. We'll see. A couple of things to keep in mind. Right now, we're projected to have a $3.5 billion surplus at the end of this biennium, June 30th, 2025. I've totaled up $5.4 billion in new spending requests. Mm-hmm. So even if we have all that surplus and revenue growth, we couldn't cover every possibly, unless you have really good revenue growth, we might not possibly cover everything that they wanted. Again, you said rare, you get what you want. Two, Republicans are not going to fund $4.3 billion more for education. They're not going to do that. They want to focus on tax cuts. So there's that whole thing to keep in mind. But starting next week, the race is on for us to get a budget done in June of 2025.
Right. Another bold ticket item on here, too, is the UW system asking for $855 million, a little bit more than that. I mean, it's a lot of money here. But no doubt, as schools every single year keep asking for more and more. What Hasselbein's point to in that video that you just watched is that a lot of schools, once again, we reached another record year of an election of how many school referendums are on the ballot. I think it was an estimate close to $6 billion across the state of how much money was on the ballot this year. So it's a trend that just keeps continuing.
And one caveat, actually, there are like 10 agencies asked for less money than base year doubled. One of them is health services. But the $440 million less at once is contingent upon doing Medicaid expansion. Mm. Republicans have rejected that in all three of Evers' budgets so far. If you don't do Medicaid expansion, you need $1.7 billion more in state money to cover the cost of health programs. 5.4 plus 1.7 needs a ton load of money. Okay, so that's the kind of the thing to keep in mind as the budget progresses. There are other things that are going to drive up costs as we move forward.
All right, and on your screen, you of course saw Department of Justice. Their request is $104 million. This leads into our next topic about a new Crime Lab report from DOJ released this week, which saw a record number of fentanyl cases in 2023. And looking at the Crime Lab report, it took them longer to process those DNA samples than the year prior, as submissions continued to climb. And this is, of course, according to the report. Now, in response to this, Attorney General Josh Call called on lawmakers for more resources. DOJ has requested in the past 16 new positions in the state budget, but lawmakers only approved three. Now the agency is seeking 19 additional positions. Unfortunately, I think we can predict that's unlikely going to happen. But it's just been this pull and tug, especially too. And there's lawmakers, especially Republicans, that are always highly critical of what's going on too, with just even sexual assault test kits. We know that was a big thing during his election of just 2 years ago.
So the argument from DOJ is going to be that we're getting more complex cases all the time, and they're going to more areas. So it's not just the number of cases that you're you have ones that go to DNA and to toxicology. There's all these overlap. It's, you know, basically much more complex than it used to be. Republicans, though, have teed up an argument that Josh calls mismanaging the crime lab. They want to go back and look at Brad Schimel, by running for Supreme Court in the spring, used to be Attorney General, the cases that came in while he was in office, how quickly they were processed, the increases since then, say Call's not doing a good job. Call's going to say, well, you guys have starved me for resources. You know these things are getting more complex. You need more help, and you're not giving it to me. That's the issue. Fast forward past his budget. There's an election in 2026 now. Call's not said he was going to do in 2026. If Governor Evers doesn't run for re-election, Josh Call is somebody who would be likely considered as a candidate for governor. If he were to run, you can bet this would become an issue in that race. Also, don't forget, we've talked last week, with Trump in the White House, 26 could be a good year for Democrats. If it is, it can help paper over issues like this. If it's not a good year for Democrats, then this becomes more of an issue for Josh Call. That's something to watch. Two, who's going to challenge Josh Call if he is running for Attorney General? And can that person, he or she, make a good argument on the crime lab that would break through that clutter in 2026? All stuff to watch long term.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing to watch is our last topic this week, which is a new search for the Democratic National Committee chair. Right now, that is by Jamie Harrison, but he is likely going to step down, opening the possibility of a familiar name here in Wisconsin, which is Ben Wickler, the massive fundraising machine often called, who is chair of course, the state Democratic Party here in Wisconsin. Now, he's been chair since 2019. He has also been touted by many prominent Democrats. I mean, it was Nancy Pelosi during the Democratic National Convention that called him Big Ben. Chuck Schumer called him one of the best chairs of a state party in the Democratic Party. So I think this just raises the question, if he leaves, JR, what does that mean for the state party here in Wisconsin?
Well, a domino starts to fall then for elections. So let's pull back to the big picture nationally. This is playing out in the national media right now. There's lots of speculation about who's going to go. It's interesting to note, remember Dean Phillips ran for president, challenged Joe Biden. His campaign manager is a known activist who said he will do whatever it takes to beat Ben Wickler if he is the for chair. That's all because Wickler, along with the rest of the Democratic Party, didn't nominate anybody for president for the ballot except for Joe Biden. Remember, Phillips had a suit to get on, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So there are detractors. But Wickler is a fundraising machine. The question is that all you need at the DNC? Is there something else going on? Statewide, though, there's a big thing happening in April, Supreme Court race.
Right.
Oh, Brad Schimel, once again, we mentioned, we tied this all together the entire show, right?
We did.
So if Wickler's still there in April, Democrats and then the liberal candidate, who right now Susan Crawford, Dane County judge, is running. Anybody else at this point is challenging her from the progressive side. Democrats would have a known fundraiser to raise money for that election. What does Wickler want to do even if his term is up in June or July, June at the convention? Does he want to stay on again in state? That's a big deal because there are elections in 2026. Tony Evers, I mean, all the statewide races, legislature. The state party has become so good at raising money, it funnels it into these other races. If Wickler's not there, who replaces him as the money person for Democrats? That's a big deal in Wisconsin. So there's all these things that are kind of like, he's kind of linchpin right now for a lot of important stuff. So now, even if he were to leave tomorrow, I'm sure he can make a few calls, get some money into Wisconsin, the Supreme Court race.
Yeah.
But looking to next year, that's kind of a big deal. And oh, by the way, Ben Wickler, if you ask anybody in Democratic circles, will tell you he wants to run for office someday in Wisconsin. The question is what? So how would going to the DNC fit in with a run for public office? Lots of moving pieces, but keep in mind, this guy is the money person for Wisconsin Democrats right now.
And I believe the last time I asked him about this, too, he's, you know, I got young kids. You know, that always plays into a factor, too, right? You don't, a lot of people don't like moving around a lot with their families. But money talks. Yeah. I'm not going to lie, right? But that is the big question ahead on what his next moves will be after having a pretty good record since coming in 2019, winning statewide elections. All right, that will do it for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next time.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.